Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast is being brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit coderedroofers.com.
South Florida, only the sun is hotter than Joyce Kaufman. It's the Joyce Kaufman Show on News Talk 850 WFTL.
Sometimes people who live in pretty unbearable situations learn more quickly than those of us who have it somewhat easy. And so I saw that a woman who happens to be a Jewish person from Persia, from Iran, has funded and constructed a giant screen with loudspeakers outside of the UCLA, whatever you want to call it, the anti-Semitic encampment. They call it pro-Hamas, or I don't know, pro-Palestinian, because if it's pro-Hamas, then it's pro-terrorism. I don't think they use that, even though that's true. So what she did was she is playing on a continuous loop footage from the October 7th massacre with the Hamas terrorists who videotaped themselves telling the story. And it's for all those people, and we've all heard them, who have decided that it never happened. You know, it's some kind of conspiracy. Well, it did happen, and they were so arrogant and proud of what they did that they videotaped it. So it's playing on a loop at UCLA. Not that people who think like these morons in the encampments care about the truth. They don't. But it still sounds to me like a brilliant strategy. And my No Restraint podcast this week talks about how you better get a brilliant strategy, because what's happening is significant. And it's not going to stop until it is stopped. And there's not a lot of, determination on the part of these college presidents, or even on the part of any of the administrators in these colleges. They're okay with this. It's just Jews, after all. They're not so okay when guys like Robert Kraft say, I'm not going to give you any more money, no more donations as an alumnus. That bothers them a little, but they figure out we'll get some very rich Chinese or Saudi Arabian to make up for whatever money they might lose to those pesky Jews. I like the idea of this billboard. But if you think we're going to get anywhere by posting billboards like, and I love Mort and the guys over at the Zionist Organization of America, they're the most sincere, wonderful people. But putting up billboards outside of, Michigan campus that, say end Jew hatred, that's not going to work. It's not enough. You got to fight fire with fire. Much like what you see happening in all of this Trump cases, these Trump cases. I'm still trying to figure out, maybe it's just me, but did everybody else get sort of surprised by the fact that there was no court today? Who gets to make that determination? Is it like the judge? Does he say, we're not going to have a session today? That would seem very unfortunate, because what it doesn't do is allow Donald Trump to make many plans if they find out sort of last minute, right? His rallies require a lot of setup. And, the press is so psychotic. Really, they are. That they end up trying to make up stories, you know, much like the stories that were made up in front of the Supreme Court. Well, what if Navy SEAL Team 6 goes and kills the opponent? Or what if this, you know, all this nonsense, which is not what we're there to talk about. But now the big headline story, because they don't have a trial to make fun of today, that the big story is that the former president, Donald Trump, could have to wear an ankle tag if he's under house arrest. What? I'm still trying to understand why they would think that was worthy of a headline. It's not even verified in any way. But I live in a world where Dan Rather gets to come back to CBS 18 years later. And in case you have forgotten or you're too young to really remember, 18 years ago, Dan Rather was very unceremoniously forced out at CBS, that show, the network that had been with him since the beginning of his career. I mean, think about it. We're coming up to a Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Dan Rather first got famous covering the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Just saying. Seems propitious to bring him back right now, don't you think? And apparently, there's a Netflix documentary coming out about him. Now, this guy is 92 years old. Mind you, 92 used to seem ridiculous to me. Not any longer. Now, it's not ridiculous anymore. But it's certainly a little long in the tooth, although we have presidents in their 80s now, and certainly senators in their 90s we've seen, so maybe it's not that long. Although, can you imagine a 92-year-old woman getting a job on CBS? No, you can't even imagine a chubby woman getting a job on CBS, unless she happened to be a member of some other minority group. If she was a chubby gay woman or a chubby African-American woman or a chubby Latina, then she could get a job, but not a chubby white person. And while Dan Rather's not chubby, he is a man, and apparently men can be old, can be fat, can be stupid, can be liars, and they can still get back on television. He does not get along with the chief of NBC, of CBS, rather, Leslie Mumbe. He was essentially became a non-person at the news division, one that he had dominated for decades. And then in this interview, he says, "I've missed it since the day I left." He did not get officially blamed for the report that got him canned, really. It was a report that George Bush's Vietnam War era National Guard service was other than it was. And here was a guy who was a reputed anchor who vouched for the authenticity of the story, even though he had no authentic documents to back it up. He thought he would survive the incident. And that's, you know, how he was functioning. But his wife told him, "You got into a fight with the president of the United States during his reelection campaign. What did you think was going to happen?" Well, it wouldn't happen now if you got into a fight with either Joe Biden, or if in 2020 you got into a fight with Donald Trump. Now all bets are off. You don't need to authenticate any stories. You can fight with whoever you want. Is there anybody in my listening audience who is going to literally watch a Netflix documentary about the guy who I first saw him on television when he was covering the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and I was a kid, and then the Vietnam War, and then Watergate, and all the rest of it? Of course, his big scoop was being at the DNC at the convention in Chicago. Well, we're about to have another one. So I think maybe they're bringing him back expressly for that. He better wear body armor. I don't care how old he is. That's not going to be anything that you want to be a part of. I remember for a while I said maybe I'll get media credentials and go. No, absolutely not. Read an article today that opponents who gathered in 2004, remember when it was the RNC in New York City? They had maybe 200,000 people show up there. A lot of them broke through police lines. There were a lot of arrests. I mean, hundreds and hundreds, maybe over 1,000 arrests. But President George W. Bush was renominated, and he did win re-election, becoming the only Republican presidential candidate to win a popular vote majority in the 35 years since the end of the Cold War. But in 2014, New York had to pay something like $18 million to settle the legal claims of people who said they had been wrongly swept up in a bunch of arrests at the convention. So the radical opponents of President Joe Biden, they want to make this big, right? They want to disrupt the Democratic National Convention in Chicago this year. And they think they can do it because they're watching what's happening at America's universities. Now, what did I say last week? I said, you're watching a rehearsal. This is what it's going to look like in November, December, and January following the election. Joe Biden's opponents, you know, can tell themselves whatever they want. Free Press had Olivia Rheingold and Eli Lake reported from a planning meeting that a bunch of activists were having. And, you know, they were planning a big time protest. This is Chicago. We got to give them a 1968 kind of welcome. Now, in 1968, as a person who was there, you had a very poorly disciplined Chicago police force. And by the way, I wasn't there for a protest, even though I got swept up in it. I was there because I was interested in politics, and my father said, let's go. Let's go to the convention. It was a horrible experience. I mean, the police were they weren't prepared. They weren't at all disciplined. And they just brutalized the protesters and the journalists right in front of TV cameras. And we saw that on television. And that was the end of the New Deal coalition of pro-segregation, conservative white Southerners, unionized workers, ethnic minority voters, and urban liberals. That year, a Republican won the presidency. And then again, in four of the next five elections. So people like me are okay. Break up that convention, turn it into a real chaotic event, because it might be the only hope for the Republican Party to get back on its feet and maybe win an election or two or even three or four. Anyway, don't forget to download the 850 WFTL app. Download it on your cell phone, download it on your laptop, your desktop, wherever. That way you can participate in all of our contests, win tickets, and you can get all the podcasts, like the No Restraint podcast goes down every Monday. And you could see, you could be listening to it right after this show or maybe, you know, later tonight while you're walking. Trust me, you'll pick up your pace if you listen to it. Let me take a quick break. I will be right back.
All these crazy alien stories can't be true, can they? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
So that's their plan, right? Is to make the political convention a mess. But it won't be easy to do. You see, back in 1968, the responsibility for the security at that convention fell upon Chicago, and they didn't have a clue. Today, we actually have a national, a federal government that does this kind of special events. It's called the National Special Security Events, and it's been in existence since Bill Clinton signed it up in 1998. And I believe the Secret Service is the overall agency in charge. So, you know, if you have a federal government that's willing to spend, I don't know, $50, $60 million, that's what they spent in 2016 to secure each of the conventions, well, then you're probably not going to have the same kind of scene that we saw in 1968 or even the scene that we saw in 2004. It's just going to be different. And, but I do not feel like I want to go. I don't think it'll be a friendly environment. And why? Why would I go to the Democratic convention? Hoping that something terrible happens? I don't even want to go to, where is it? The Republican convention is what, in Minnesota, I think. I definitely don't want to go there. So that's the story. I've been reading over a lot of the transcripts and information from the Supreme Court hearings that took place last week. Of course, in particular, I'm interested in the hearing about presidential immunity. And I saw some commentary over the weekend that quoted the Justice Gorsuch, who suggested when he was involved in a line of questioning, he said that if you don't afford immunity to former presidents, and in this case, I mean, they're obviously talking about Donald Trump, then any future president could be targeted after they leave office. It doesn't really matter what the president's motives were. And that's what Gorsuch said. He said that's something courts shouldn't get engaged in, because the concern is, will criminal law targeting political opponents be a problem? You know, is that how they're going to operate in the future based on whatever accusations about their motives, right? Having an NDA isn't unusual, especially for the very wealthy like Donald Trump and for political persons running for public office. So you got to really be thoughtful when you make a decision like this. Immunity is not just about Donald Trump. It's going to be about Joe Biden. It's going to be about every subsequent president if they change anything. During the hearing, it was Justice Gorsuch who said that future presidents could potentially pardon themselves before leaving offices if the Supreme Court doesn't rule that they should at least enjoy some kind of immunity, at least partial immunity for certain things. And then the justice said he doesn't want to have to make a decision on whether a president can use that authority or not. We have never answered whether a president can do that because it's never been presented to the Supreme Court before. Can you issue a pardon to yourself? Never happened. What would happen if presidents were afraid that their successors would criminally prosecute them for their acts in office? They only have to look at this to see it's possible. What would it be like if they allowed the Republican president, Donald Trump, to prosecute President Barack Obama for ordering a drone strike that ended up killing civilians? Because that's the same story, only more sort of easy to understand than this. So him and a couple of the other conservative-leaning justices said they were much less concerned about President Trump's charges, but way more concerned about the Supreme Court's ruling on immunity in general. We're writing a rule for the ages. And during the hearing, a lot of the justices appeared to be very skeptical that President Trump should be declared absolutely immune from prosecution in Jack Smith's case. But some of the justices signaled that, the recent D.C. appeals court ruling that rejected President Trump's immunity arguments has to be revisited. Justice Alito said that whatever we decide, it's going to apply to all future presidents. That's the part that these political hacks don't ever think about. How you could literally, this could come back to bite either party, any individual who decides they want to run for the highest office in the land. I don't get it. I don't know why anybody would want that job. I can't think of a more thankless job at this point. And meanwhile, you got this Jack Smith asking for, he wants this decided really quick. The court usually issues its opinions by the end of June, which would be, 4 months before the election. The U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan, who's the one who's going to preside over the trial, said pretrial issues could take up to 3 months. So this trial, depending on, what I saw or believing that I understood what I saw in reading over the justices questioning last week, this trial is not going to go on before November. So there's all kinds of potential constitutional craziness ahead of us. Because imagine if the president wins the election, if President Trump wins the election, and now he's scheduled to be inaugurated in January, and somewhere in maybe November, there's a trial, and you just can't even wrap your mind around that. Now, of course, he wasn't allowed to be in the Supreme Court on the 25th when these arguments were taking place, because, of course, he's sitting in a freezing cold New York courtroom, which, by the way, why would it be kept freezing cold? I heard Mark Levin opine that they just want this, they just want Donald Trump to be as uncomfortable as possible, which made perfect sense to me. They are relentless and they are absolutely without any compunction to bring down this entire country, to bring down every system that we hold dear. Justice. This Justice Department has run amok, and apparently even the Supreme Court doesn't know how to deal with them. And that's interesting. Now, a side story before I take a break. Guess who got together in the last couple of days? That's right, Donald Trump and Governor Ron DeSantis. Now, I think everybody is pretty sure that Governor DeSantis plans on running in 2028. At least I would venture to say that's a good bet. I'll take that bet. But now he's endorsed Donald Trump for president this time, even though he publicly trashed his electability and he trashed his recruiting methods for the Veep, He's busy being Ron DeSantis. He's a governor, apparently he requested this opportunity to sit down and talk with Donald Trump. Now, I'm going to tell you something. Ron DeSantis is a very smart man. And if Donald Trump wins the presidency in November, Ron DeSantis cannot afford to be on the outs with Donald Trump. Not if he plans on going to the next level in his political career. So you're beginning to see this shift taking place. He is going to be fundraising for Donald Trump. He made that announcement back in the beginning of the month of April when he was at some fundraiser in Hollywood. And I am sure that that was part of his conversation with Donald Trump over the weekend. And if you say to Donald Trump, I'm on board and I'm going to help you raise money, all is forgiven. Because the donor class loves Ron DeSantis. That's how he lasted as long as he did in those primaries. And he raised, what did he raise? I think it was like $200 million for his gubernatorial reelection. And of course, then he parlayed it into his failed presidential election, but it makes perfect sense for Trump and for DeSantis and really for the whole Republican Party. So watch carefully. He's holding his fire and he's making nice, Governor DeSantis is. And that's a good, it's a positive sign for the Republican Party. By the way, he is very busy being the governor again, which makes me say out loud what I said when he first announced. How can you do both? You can't campaign for the presidency and be a good governor. You just can't. Nor can you sit in a courtroom, a freezing cold courtroom, for days on end and be a good campaigner, unless you're Donald Trump. All right, let me take a quick break. I'll be right back. Stay where you are. So I'm sure we have all been wondering, you know, whether these protests, these anti-Jewish rallies are going to start taking place in Florida colleges. And, you know, I really didn't see much about it this weekend until I saw that there was a controversy at University of Florida and that a pro-Palestinian protest. Now, let's remember, these are not pro-Palestinian protests. These are pro-Hamas protests. And Hamas is a terrorist organization. So we should not be pro-terrorists at any level. So apparently the university has said that if a student or one of the faculty, or any employee actually, is involved in one of these protests, that they could be banned from campus. So some of the students and members of the community gathered at the Plaza of the Americas for an emergency protest in solidarity with, they say, with Gaza, demanding the university to divest from Israel and apartheid. And since then, protesters have continued to occupy the campus. And there are a couple of other Florida universities have seen some protests, but they've been smaller and quieter and without the forceful police presence that you're seeing around the country. I don't know whether that'll fly here at all. I doubt it. But I think there's something that we need to know about this governor and this legislature. They are not going to tolerate this kind of stuff. And until we get to a point in this country where no college tolerates this kind of stuff, it will continue. And it will only grow. I mean, that's the purpose. They're trying to disrupt, and they're being successful. So you ought to really encourage elected leadership, and certainly your alma maters as well, to put their foot down. I just, you know, I wish I hadn't spent as much time this weekend as I did looking at all the Supreme Court information, because I really missed the 800 arrests that were made over the weekend, all over the place, University of Arizona, and of course, plenty in Boston, Northeastern, and Harvard, you know, you name it. Crazy left-wing Massachusetts, we didn't expect anything different from them. New York City continues to be rocked by this, but UCLA, lots of schools, even in blue states, they don't want this to go on. They have to cancel graduation in California for USC. That's crazy. These kids didn't have it bad enough that their freshman year and maybe even their sophomore year was COVID and they were taking classes online. Now they're back to that because of this lunacy that's being tolerated on the campuses. I don't get it. I really don't. But as I said, you know, I keep looking at these Supreme Court opinions and keep thinking, I was looking at what is the left saying about these arguments and what is the right saying? Because, of course, it's not going to be the same. So the left is saying that this is going to be a legacy-defining decision for the court. And some say the court needs to focus more on issuing a timely ruling than an important or a consequential one. How could that make sense to anybody? Others are disheartened at some of the justices' apparent receptiveness to Trump's arguments. On CNN, Steve Vladek wrote, John Roberts has quite a mess in front of him. Four of the justices, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, Neil Gorsuch, and Brett Kavanaugh, expressed support for different arguments that would each pose serious, if not fatal, obstacles to the case. Four of the justices, Sotomayor, Kagan, Amy Coney Barrett, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, seemed to support a ruling that would allow most, if not all, of the charges to go forward. And if that holds, the fate of the January 6th prosecution likely rests in the hands of the justice who spoke first and last on Thursday, but who did the least to reveal his views, and that's the Chief Justice John Roberts. Once again, he sits in that seat of, being the deciding voice. And he's just so not reliable for a conservative. I really don't understand this Amy Coney Barrett. I thought she was a strict constitutionalist. And yet, I don't know, is she just hanging around with the girls? Why all four women would be on the same side on this ruling seems a little suspect to me. Maybe they made her an offer, you want to be part of this sisterhood, you better take a stand against Trump. Meanwhile, she's a Trump appointee. Not that I think she should suspend her constitutional arguments because of the appointment, but certainly I thought that was pretty clear what kind of a justice she was going to be. No, not so clear. Brett Kavanaugh, he has his good days and his bad days. I think he's on the right page here. Of course, we count on Clarence Thomas because he's the best. Samuel Alito, good. Gorsuch seems great. And that's it. They each expressed support for different arguments. And look, I don't believe that it's going to be blanket immunity. I never thought it would. But I think if they get all caught up in trying to figure out what they should declare as personal stuff and what they should declare as official business, they're going to get bogged down. And that's not what's in front of them. What's in front of them is this case. And, they said such crazy things in the press over the weekend, the left. They said, from all his mad greed and compulsive lawlessness, for all his sleaze and stupidity, crime is ultimately not Trump's game. Trump is nothing like a master criminal. He's a master of something far more sinister and complex, corruption. Crime is a largely private endeavor. Corruption is public. I mean, I forgot who said that, but I wrote it down because in shorthand, I hope I got it right. And then the guy went, the Supreme Court is drunk on arrogated power. Cut loose from rudimentary ethics has been eaten alive by it. Oh, please. Wish I could remember who said that. I think it was Francis Wilkinson in the LA Times. But anyway, and then what is the right saying? Well, the right says broad presidential immunity is key to a functioning democracy and that the court should resist calls to issue a speedy ruling in this case. And of course, others insist that Trump's immunity claims cannot be allowed to stand. Mark Weaver in Newsweek said, the founding fathers couldn't have foreseen Trump, but they still immunized him. And I think that's the truth. If a president slips out of the White House and kills someone he's mad at, he can be criminally prosecuted and politically impeached. The tougher question, which is the one that's being debated in the Supreme Court now, is this. When a president carries out his official duties, can he be prosecuted for that? We know for sure he can't be sued for it. If a threat of being ordered to pay money for a civil claim is a deterrent enough to distract a president from doing the work of the executive branch, imagine the threat of being sent to prison. that's huge. But one need not even mention Donald Trump's presidency to illustrate precisely why the founding fathers said it's impeachment. That is the ultimate punishment for a president. Criminal charges as a political tool to neutralize and distract the commander-in-chief was a concern for the Founding Fathers, and it's still a concern for me. Their Constitution protects official presidential actions from both civil and criminal prosecution. And if not questioning an election isn't an official duty, of course it is. As the president, he's supposed to make sure elections are fair. Now what we're seeing is law being used as a weapon of political revenge. And who loses? We lose. Our democracy loses. This republic loses. And it doesn't uphold justice like they keep screaming on the left. It actually undermines it. Rich Lowry said, "Don't rush the Trump J6 case," in the National Review. He said, "As for the sweeping, unanimous decision of the D.C. Circuit that denied Trump's claim of immunity and that Trump's critics considered dispositive, Chief Justice John Roberts, who is not a MAGA extremist, made it clear that he thinks it's desperately flawed. Trump's critics are putting partisan considerations, that's the belief that a trial in and of itself, and even more so a conviction, will hurt Trump politically, and their hatred for Trump, and his post-election conduct before everything else, in their demand for a fast ruling, and one that's the most damaging to Trump. This is a very bad impulse. When you're asking the court to create a precedent that will affect every president going forward, the idea that a complicated case relying on a very novel use of federal statutes and involving a former president should or could be slammed through the courts like a case about an overdue parking ticket, that's ridiculous. The court will almost certainly reject Trump's extravagant claims of immunity while quite possibly blessing a more limited version. And they may ask the judge in the J6 case to determine which of his acts were official and which were private. I hope not. I just think that's not what we're here for. That's not why it's in front of them. They seem open to a scope of presidential immunity, certainly from criminal prosecution. Almost nothing in the actual text of the Constitution actually talks about that, though. But if you listen to Kavanaugh's questions, I read Alito and Kavanaugh, they kept asking questions that showed their concern of things they thought were constitutionally alarming, that just violate the Constitution. Trump, my take is I'm surprised to see how many justices were open to immunity. I was. And I don't think the court has to make some sort of historic stand here. It just has to rule on the case. Impeachment is a political tool. Prosecutions are for criminal acts. And I don't see why one should rely on the other. All right, don't forget, coming up after me is Eric Erickson, followed by Joe Pags, the Overnight Guys, and then at 6 a.m., Jen and Bill will be back with the South Florida Morning Show, followed by Brian Kilmeade at 9 and Dan Bongino at noon. Me coming back at 3, but I still have one segment left today, so stay right where you are. I'll be right back. I was looking at Alex Berenson's Undisputed Truths. Unreported Truths, rather, when I say undisputed, Unreported Truths blog today. And he said something that I think is extremely important. I've said it before in other ways, but he said that the crime that the prosecutor, Colangelo, claimed that Donald Trump had committed, this scheme, is not the falsifying of business records, because that's a misdemeanor. But he said in his opening statement that this jury has to decide if Trump is guilty of some sort of conspiracy. And win or lose, this is going to destabilize our legal system for decades. I think about that. Back in 2009, a veteran defense attorney by the name of Harvey Silverglate wrote a book called Three Felonies a Day, How the Feds Target the Innocent. And it talks about how U.S. attorneys use these sort of vague laws to bring indictments against unpopular politicians or big business executives they don't like. And it just keeps getting worse because the federal criminal code just keeps getting expanded and prosecutors keep pushing its limits. The Justice Robert Jackson, who was the chief American prosecutor in Nuremberg at the criminal trials after World War II, this is what he said. After explaining why a federal prosecutor must choose cases carefully and recognize that not every crime can be pursued, Jackson turned to the heart of his talk. If the prosecutor is obliged to choose his cases, it follows that he can choose his defendants. And here one finds the most dangerous power of the prosecutor, that he will pick people that he thinks he should get, rather than pick cases that need to be prosecuted. Silverglate expressed less concern about state prosecutors because tighter statutes restricted them and they focused on more obvious crimes. But the Trump indictment actually flips his concern about the power of federal prosecutors and local politicians on its head. In this case, local prosecutors, who answer only to local voters in a heavily Democratic county, aren't just stretching a state criminal statute to its limits, they're doing so explicitly to punish a Republican politician over his tactics in his race for president, which is the only true national election in the United States. So to be clear, prosecutors haven't charged Donald Trump with committing any crime in 2016. He's charged with technical violations of violating bookkeeping laws in 2017. In fact, the actual crime that he supposedly committed is really funny. I mean, it's not funny. It's unimportant. He supposedly misclassified $420,000 in expenses in internal accounting records as legal services when they were actually reimbursements for payments that Michael Cohen said he made on his behalf. But the 2016 election underlies the indictment, and not in a subtle way. The government's star witness during the trial's first week was David Pecker. He was a former publisher of the National Enquirer. And he testified about how he'd been trying to improve Donald Trump's image in the years before 2016, before the election. He paid Karen McDougal $150,000 to get the exclusive rights to her story, then he buried it. Pretty seamy. But these are the witnesses that they've trotted out. Trump's not even charged for anything related to the National Enquirer's payments to McDougal, but they still brought him up on the stand. You really... assume that the prosecutors are correct. Assume that Trump's only motive for hiding his affairs was to improve the chances he would win in 2016, that he didn't want to keep them secret for some other reason, like maybe to protect his marriage. Assume also that he actually coordinated with Pecker and the National Enquirer to hide McDougal's story. Then the response you're going to get from me is, so what? Why on earth is Trump on trial? In 2016, Hillary Clinton's campaign used campaign funds to pay for the Steele dossier, which was a fake report linking Trump to Russia. That's not a conspiracy theory. In 2022, her campaign and the DNC paid a $113,000 fine to the FEC to settle the investigation into the payments. Nice, right? But her campaign worked with all the friendly news organizations to plant stories based on that research. Everybody thought the pee-pee tapes were real. This is garbage. We all know it's garbage. And the world is watching this, and the world is thinking, boy, even in the United States, tin pot despots like Joe Biden and his crew, an entire party will do something this disgusting to a former president. I'll be back tomorrow at 3 o'clock if it be his will and he delays his coming. May God bless you. May God bless Israel, and may God bless the United States of America. Listen to today's podcast.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast has been brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit CodeRedRoofers.com.